Hi, I'm Kevin Flynn, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today, we're talking about episode 7 of the team's latest series on The State versus Jason Carroll, which deals with the 1988 murder of Sharon Johnson of Bow, New Hampshire. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, well, this conversation may not make a whole lot of sense, so make sure you go back and do that before listening on. Our guests today are Cynthia Mousseau. She's the attorney for the New England Innocence Project. She joined in 2019 as the first staff attorney focused primarily on New Hampshire casework. Prior to joining NEIP, Cynthia was a public defender in both Massachusetts and New Hampshire for about 8 years. Cynthia, hello. Thanks for joining us on the addendum.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by Rabia. Rabia Chaudhry is the lead investigator and one of the hosts of the Undisclosed podcast. Hello, Rabia.
Hey, Kevin. How are you?
You made it back from Aspen okay? You didn't break a leg skiing or anything crazy?
There was zero skiing involved, which is how it should remain for me. But yeah, made it back. I and all the other folks I was with were all having reentry issues. Coming back to the real world kind of sucks, but you know.
Well, just don't live in the real world like I do. So,
you know, just run away to Aspen, which I could never afford. But I wanted to add one thing, a very important thing to Cynthia's introduction, which is that she is Jason Carroll's attorney.
Ah, well, I certainly was, you know, wondering why she was here. but the Innocence Project does great work all over the country. But I think that, you know, the work done in New Hampshire is not, or throughout New England, does not seem to get the same kind of headlines because, as Rabia, as you mentioned earlier in the season, New Hampshire doesn't have a reputation for coming up with a lot of wrongful convictions because of a relatively conservative prosecutorial philosophy. Cynthia, I'm assuming you would disagree with that.
Yeah. So I think, well, there's two things. So first of all, the Innocence Project is separate from us. So sometimes when we see that Innocence Project headlines, that's a separate, they are an independent organization. The New England Innocence Project is just covers the six New England states. The big difference is IP Innocence Project is based out of New York. They do only DNA cases. We take cases that are beyond DNA that would, you know, be based in things beyond DNA. And, you know, NEIP never really had an attorney in New Hampshire until I joined the team the beginning of 2019. So there was really nobody sort of looking up here. I mean, I think our criminal legal culture is actually probably pretty similar to the criminal legal culture in a lot of states. We put these safeguards into our system to protect people from being convicted when they're innocent. But whether those safeguards work often depends on who those safeguards are going to protect, right? We can see this in Jason's case. We have police procedures that are put in place to protect against extracting false confessions. Those fail Jason. We have prosecutors that make charging choices about when they have sufficient, reliable evidence to charge someone. That fails Jason. We have judges that would serve as gatekeepers that would prevent unreliable evidence from being presented at the jury. That failed Jason. We have juries to make sure that people would have opportunities for others to see their innocence. That fails Jason, right? The prosecutors here aren't any more conservative than any other prosecutors. One thing we know about New Hampshire is that there have only been two exonerations in this state. But what we know is those exonerations really don't look like the other exonerations in the rest of the country. And we know that because of the data we have from around the rest of the country, that low number is not a reflection of the fact that there was actually only two people wrongfully convicted in the state, but instead that the people that are wrongfully convicted really haven't been found yet and remain incarcerated and in prison. So when we say that New Hampshire prosecutors are conservative, it conveys this idea that they only charge folks that are guilty. And those statistics that we've just talked about and the stack of very viable applications sitting on my desk would certainly suggest that's not the case. Not to mention the man that we're all talking about who's been sitting in prison for almost 33 years would obviously also beg to differ about those conservative prosecutors.
Can you tell us about those two exonerations that you're talking about, which I looked at and like you said, they're not exonerations in the way that most people consider exonerations.
So, right. When we think about exonerations, like, you know, like in, you know, in like a global, not, I want to say global, but more in a national sense, we have this sense of these like decades long periods of time in prison where there is, you know, a number of things going wrong. The legal battle takes so much time to mount, to investigate, to do all the work. And the exonerations are only, it's only through essentially miracles that they're granted. In these New Hampshire cases that are the exonerations that have been happening, I don't mean to demean the work that's been done there, because obviously there has been some work done there, but those exonerations took place after a relatively short period of incarceration, if any, really, honestly. And so it becomes this question of, you know, what has happened in these scenarios is obviously very different than what we know happens more nationally, and obviously what we know happened in Jason's case. So, and I think those exonerations, and you know, I can't tell you that I'm an expert on those, because that would not be true. But my recollection is that they're both sort of similar recantation cases. And I think New Hampshire kind of takes those seriously, you know, and at, you know, as everybody should. But I think those recantations happened relatively quickly, and they were a sexual assault cases. And so those are quite different than what we're looking at and what we're considering. It takes quite a bit more work on all levels, on the investigation end, on the litigation end, and going forward, for these longer term incarcerations with, you know, murder at the center of it. These are obviously just very different in substance and in process, honestly.
The reason I asked that is because when I was doing some research on this, and I don't remember because it's been a while, maybe a year or so since I looked at this, what I realized that I didn't find any exonerations in the state of New Hampshire. What I found was, I think it was a couple of cases in which fairly early on charges were dropped, or there was something else that had happened that were counted amongst, like, there's a national registry of exonerations. But like you said, they weren't like exonerations the way we think of exonerations. I'm going to get more into that later, but because I do think it's important to understand that if you're able to succeed in this case, basically, Cynthia, it would like kind of be the first of its kind case.
Yes, this is the first of its kind case. This is the first of its kind work done in New Hampshire. This is the first time anybody's looking. And it would be a first on a lot of fronts.
Cynthia, can you tell us how long have you been working on Jason's case?
Yeah, so I've been working on Jason's case since I joined. Jason applied to us in 2016. I started with NEEP, as I said a couple times, I think, in early 2019. As my first case, this was it. Jason's case was the first case I started working on in depth. We had a bunch of documents from Jason's sister, Jackie, who I know we heard from last week. I reached out to Jackie. I'm in regular contact with Jackie and Jason now for pretty much just shy of, you know, 3 years that I've been working at NEEP. And I mean, I think it's really important to understand this is so much more than this like true crime story or the salacious moment in New Hampshire history. These are really amazing, strong people, right? Jason is one of the most thoughtful, gentle, and old souls. He's been incarcerated since he was 19. He spent 6 years or so in prime adolescent brain development time in prison. All of his adult life has been in prison, but he continues to be extremely positive and be a real presence in the life of folks outside the walls. And that's really actually very significant, considering that the only contact he can really have is, you know, phone contact. He's always growing, learning. He takes class after class. He's this incredible artist. He makes this incredible woodwork. He's made these incredible, beautiful things. He did gut-wrenching hospice work inside the prison. He's extremely loyal. He's very protective. He's very thoughtful. He's sort of this like Marlboro man, kind of old school, strong, silent type. And I see so much of Jackie and Jason and Jason and Jackie. She is just absolutely loyal and persistent. She is, her insights are invaluable. I am so honored to be able to be a part of this team with Jackie. And, you know, we have a law firm that's absolutely wonderful that's working with us on this case, Foley Hoag. And we are all really excited to hopefully be able to make some progress in Jason's case.
I'm always curious about how these two organizations end up shaking hands between what Cynthia is doing and the undisclosed team. So, who reached out to whom first, and how did you figure out that, yeah, this is something worth pursuing? Robbie, do you want to go first? Do you reach out first?
It can go either way. I mean, in this case, NEEP reached out to me, and we're going to have the executive director of NEEP, Radha, on, I think, maybe next week or the week after on the addendum. reached out to me a couple of years ago and said, you know, I listen Undisclosed and I have a case that I think would be great. And, you know, she sent me some details and it piqued my curiosity. At the time, I think I was working on Greg Lance's case. And, you know, the more I looked, I was like, oh my God, you know, and I explained to her that, you know, like everybody has to be on board and we were going to need access to, like, you know, like try to interview folks. And if you're okay with us all getting all up in the mud in this case, then fine. And she was like, yeah, no, that's fine. So yeah, actually they had reached out to us, which was a great honor really, for NEEP to trust us to work on this.
And Cynthia, when you found out that Rabia and her group was going to be highlighting this case where you like at first, someone's coming in and sort of, you know, auditing the stuff that I'm doing and maybe I'm uncomfortable because I'm in my area working hard, or you're like, well, the publicity might actually help.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's so complicated, especially coming from a public defense background where we are so resistant to talking about stories in the press because they are often so manipulated into something that we, you know, we didn't think they were going to be. I think the thing that really stood out to me about Undisclosed and with Rabia is I had listened to Serial, obviously. I definitely had a different perspective on Serial, I think, than like the general public. And so when I had known about Adnan's story, I ended up sort of following Rabia sort of after that point into Undisclosed, where you sort of get this different perspective. I think that was really valuable. I knew so much about Jackie, and I really felt like Rabia was going to bring a perspective to this case that was going to be really valuable. And I really felt like it would be very supportive for Jason and his family and Jackie. And I just think that, you know, being able to have a shared experience where you have a loved one that's incarcerated is just something that's very hard to come across with a lot of true crime podcasts. Again, it's often spoken about in these very cold terms, or the way that cases are described is very academic. And we forget that real people are involved on all sides of this. And one of the things that I feel like we were really excited about working with Rabia about is that we were not worried about that. We felt like the personal piece was always going to be something that was going to be valued because she understood, you know, what it was like to have this person who's totally unseen, you know, behind these prison walls. And I think that's one thing that we were really glad about.
Yeah. In other words, it's a good podcast. And I would agree. I would agree. So we have heard, and Cynthia, you kind of talked a little bit about this earlier on, that, you know, maybe there's this philosophy about being very conservative when bringing prosecutions. And yet we have, a case that was brought against Jason Carroll with all of these red flags around it. You know, we hear Thomas Sexton saying, oh, well, they're not going to go unless they have X, Y, and Z. How do you square that they went forward with prosecuting Jason? And also, Tony, with, you know, there's all these sort of holes and contradictions within the confessions and the way that they were obtained. I mean, do you have a theory, Cynthia? I mean, does it have to do with Ken Carpenter?
So one of the things I want to talk about, first of all, is I just want to talk about the word confession, right?
Okay,
words and language are so important to us, and they carry these meanings and also these implications. So when we say confession, it implies I take responsibility for an action I did. And that's a lot, right? It's one, admitting you did this action, and two, admitting that you had some responsibility for that. I always try to think of a different word for it. And I often use the word statement, which seems more neutral, but it implies then that the person is saying words of their own volition. In other words, words that they chose to say. Here, I don't feel like Jason or Tony are really making statements, because they're really not saying words that they came up with on their own. They're really only saying words that they're being coerced into saying. And he's certainly, neither one of them are making confessions. There's really no English word to describe a scenario where words come out of your mouth that someone else made you say. It's kind of like that Jedi mind trick where Obi-Wan's trying to protect C-3PO and R2-D2, the droids, from the stormtroopers in Star Wars. And Obi-Wan says, these are not the droids you're looking for, while waving his hand in front of the stormtrooper. And the stormtrooper under the Jedi mind control says, these are not the droids we're looking for, right? Is the stormtrooper talking? Is he making a statement? Is he confessing? No, right? And there's really no English word for Jedi mind control used by the Sith to coerce words from somebody else's mouth. So I agree that these statements that they make, you know, I sometimes say coerced confession or false confession, but those are so long. I'm just going to use the term statement. because that's what is a little more neutral, that confession, but there just isn't a perfect word for this. So I guess what I would say is, you know, this was a serious case, right? And as I said, right, like the reality is that this criminal legal system is the same everywhere. Everybody is trying to solve cases and everybody's intentions come from a good place. But often when we're trying to pursue something with the best intentions, you know, things get done and mistakes get made. And, you know, we can get into, you know, with prosecutors and with police and with defense attorneys, with everyone, there's this phenomenon that we talk about called tunnel vision, where essentially you get this idea in your head that you're going to pursue a certain lead. And you just pursue it and you just believe anything that lines up with that lead, and anything that's sort of inconsistent with that lead, you sort of discount that. And that's not conscious. I mean, nobody purposefully ignores relevant information, but the reality is we discount all of those things and we really don't see this wider picture. So when the case is presented in a forum like this, where we can explore the different aspects of the case, it creates a much broader perspective. At the time, the perspective was very, very clear. It was very clear exactly what the police are trying to do. And once they extract these statements from Jason and from Tony, the prosecutor's position essentially was probably, you know, we have this unsolved murder in New Hampshire. It's not very common to have murders in New Hampshire, number one, especially not of a woman who had no known essential enemies and who was pregnant at the time. It's very scary for the public. It's very scary to leave that unsolved. They needed to solve it. They found this way out. It was an easy way out. And I think that's really what they did. You know, I think the police perspective that the prosecutors are conservative is very consistent with police perspective everywhere. They think they have solved the case themselves and that there's enough information. The reality is that, again, the criminal legal system has safeguards built into place to make sure that we have enough evidence. And the prosecutors being careful or conservative in a case would be actually an inaction, a demonstration of that safeguard being put in place, right? The police is one level, the prosecutors is another level, there's the judge, there's the jury, as we talked about before. And I think in this particular case, the prosecutors obviously were not conservative, but they were more conservative than the police, who were probably ready to go before the prosecutors were, right? So I think it's just sort of like everyone's jumping the gun. Whether it should have been later or earlier, I think it shouldn't have been at all. And I think the tunnel vision rather than the timing was really the problem.
So, Cynthia, for the sake of our conversation, I hope that you will forgive me for using the term confession in places. It is how the prosecutors and police describe these statements. Robbie, there were a series of what they called confessions. Can you tell us how many there were and the order they went?
Yeah, that was something that I think was, and I totally understand. I mean, I think with this episode, you kind of needed to like be charting it as you went. I mean, I consider Tony's first statement back in March, I think March of 89, to be kind of like the first time the police got anybody to accept responsibility for anything. So that was when he said that Ken had asked him to move the car, and Tony said he did it, but he didn't know Sharon had been killed. That's in March. They spend like pretty much the rest of the year trying to corner Tony and find anything they can on him. They get to Jason as they're going through Tony's colleagues at work, and Jason folds, really the first time they talk to him, which was on November 24th, 1989. So it's quite a while after Tony's that one statement. That's the day that Jason's like, he tells his friend, I just got to go talk to the police. They want to talk to me, thinking nothing of it. By the time he gets home that night, he's a hot mess. And he tells his mother, I said stuff that I didn't mean and I want to take it back and I don't know what's going on. The next day he wants to recant. So that's Jason's first kind of confession or statement. The next day he wants to recant. Instead of a recantation, it turns into a whole nother digging himself deeper. And this is when his mother, Karen, is in the room. That's number two. Number three would really be, the next day he's asked to draw diagrams, which he fails repeatedly. But at the same time, I guess you can also make the argument that that was him accepting some part, having some knowledge of the crime. And then the following day, the 27th, which is Monday, I think, that's the day that he gives kind of a full-throated, I'm ready to go, press play on the tape recorder confession. That's the one where the quality was pretty good. We heard that. And it's that same day, later in the day, that evening, that Tony's like, all right, fine. And Tony gives in too. As far as I remember, I think that's the only time Tony does. And Tony will, as we'll hear in next episode, take it all back soon enough too.
Cynthia, what were the big red flags that you heard with all those different statements?
I mean, I don't know that we have enough time to go over everything that went wrong in all of these things. You know, and one thing, a point I want to make about sort of, and I know it's very hard for people to conceptualize this, but it's actually very common for there to be multiple. So when we think about this as, you know, Jason's statement and Tony's statement, like really those are very, very intertwined, right? Because one of the things that Haley Cleary spoke about, one of the things that I think is really important to note is sort of these, the interrogators will contaminate you with facts. And then you know that those are the facts that you're supposed to repeat because those are the facts that they told you. And in this case, the interrogators used Jason to contaminate Tony with facts. And that's how Tony has these facts to begin with. And so that timing is so critical because the reality is Jason is sent to speak to Tony and the investigators write a report saying Jason tells Tony what he told the police. So Tony has been given the facts from Jason, and what Tony then ends up doing is providing these details that don't align with what Jason's details are, right? So this is one piece, right? That Jason and Tony's statements are inconsistent with each other because Jason didn't give those details to Tony, right? So in a normal scenario, if we found out that the facts of a quote unquote confession didn't match with the facts of the case, we would discount that confession. And that's certainly not the case here. I think that's one piece. So Jason's statements being inconsistent with each other, wildly inconsistent with each other. Well, that's one piece. Jason's statements being inconsistent with Tony's. That's another piece. Tony's statements being inconsistent within each other. That's another piece. And then of course, when we get into the details of Jason's case, the statements that he makes are inconsistent with physical evidence. They're inconsistent with the timelines. I know that the episode talked a lot about the timelines, but the way Jason's talking about things, this, you know, murder is over and done with by, you know, 8 p.m. essentially there. And he's back at the mall at 8:30, maybe 8:10. He's back at the mall at 8:30. We know that's not true because Sharon is seen around 8 p.m. at the mall. So we know that's not right, right? Jason originally tells the police that, you know, Tony gave him the money that night. Well, we know that's not true for a number of reasons. We know that nobody had any money. Even if that was the case, that they had gotten money, right? It's not consistent in terms of like, Ken wouldn't have had that money yet. I mean, right? The whole theory is he's going to kill Sharon to get this insurance money to pay them so that he can pay his debts. I mean, he doesn't have enough money to pay anybody at this point, which is, you know, part of the state's theory. You know, and Tony doesn't, of course, say that that's what happened. The number of wounds in her back is inconsistent. The bra piece, I know that was discussed on the episode, that's inconsistent. What Jason did with the money, that's inconsistent. You know, I think the stereo piece is just so such an interesting piece to me. And, you know, I want to point out that that was not a witness who was like happy with Jason at the time. Like he had not been paying his truck bills, right? Like this was his opportunity to say something mean about Jason. But what he says is, no, no, that stereo was there when I, you know, that stereo was in place at the time.
Robbie, I think that the one inconsistency that really jumped out at me was the idea that Ken had a beard, because in Jason and Tony's statements, they keep describing Ken as having this beard, which I guess he grew at the time that Lammy and other folks came in, but at the time of the homicide, he was clean shaven. I mean, that just seems like a huge red flag to me. What
yeah,
about you?
We have no idea whether or not Ken had a beard at the time that Lammy stepped in. What I think happened is that they believed that Ken had a beard because of this one statement of a witness from the mall.
That's
so they thought
right.
that might have been Ken. And they kind of went with it. And then after Jason gives all these statements, they get this video footage of Ken literally the night before the murder. It's footage of him in his car at the ATM. He pulls up and I think it's like midnight or something, really late. And voila, he's clean shaven, as he usually was. Most people I spoke to said that they did not remember Ken have, like, there were times once in a while he'd grow like kind of a very close to the face beard, but most of the time he didn't have it. But certainly the night before the murder, he did not have a big bushy beard, and within 24 hours he didn't sprout one. So yeah, that whole thing was so clearly, I think. But you know, to me, the timings are all off, right? Like there's just, even how Jason is saying that, Jason and Tony's statements don't match up at all. Like, in almost every single respect, about where they met Sharon, about who drove the car, about when this all started. Jason says he was told the day before. Tony says it was like a week before. I mean, like, none of it matches up. The money, Jason says, we got the money that Saturday morning, and we're going to get to that Saturday morning in next episode, why that Saturday morning's so important. Tony says they got it that same night, which was impossible for them to do, because had they gone to the house that night, at the time, he says, you know, Ken wasn't there. The girls were there. And then can we just go back to the fact that Tony's working all night? Tony's working all night. So anyhow, none of it makes sense.
Of course, there's the huge piece, right, is this inability to identify Ken, but he's still calling him Ken Johnson. So mm-hmm. either the reality is that he is at the scene and there's four people and this person isn't Ken Johnson and the person that he picked out of the mugshots is Ken Johnson. But that, because that's not consistent with what the police believe, right, he's now got it in his head that this is who Ken Johnson is. Jason doesn't know who Ken Johnson is. He doesn't know.
Yeah. And Ken, by the way, doesn't know who Jason is. And we'll be getting to that either. And, you know, the other thing, like, you know, we have to keep remembering is that there were people at the murder scene, like, that night around 8:40, who were there. And so it's like, what happened? How do you explain them being there and not seeing any of this happening? Like, how do you explain any of that? It just, none of it makes sense.
Yeah, and it does seem like there were instances in the questioning that the investigators fed details to Jason and Tony, something, I remember there was something about driving, you know, away from the scene on the back road when there is no back, you know, exit to the site. Again, that's one of the things that we keep hearing about, flaws in the read technique. You heard similar things, I'm assuming, Cynthia?
Similar things, you mean, in terms of, is the problem, like, the use of read?
Yeah, well, you know, in particular that, you know, the investigators would let something sort of slip out. I mean, they're trying to get to point C, and they feel like they can't get there until they establish points A and B, so they're feeding the information whether they mean to or not.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly it, right? And this goes along with this tunnel vision and the subconscious bias that we're sort of talking about, right? Like, these police think they've got the right guy, and this is all well-intentioned. We want to catch this person that committed this atrocious thing, right? So, like, we're trying to pursue this course of action that we think makes the most sense. So they continue to do that. And when things aren't consistent, they quote-unquote clarify, which is, I think, the term that they're always using. To clarify, Jason, how many roads? To clarify, Jason, what path did you take? Isn't it true, Jason, that you went down Elm Street and then turned here and then turned here after Jason's told you he doesn't know? He doesn't know how he got there. He doesn't know what the roads were, any of those sorts of things. I think the reality is they are conveying. This is the Jedi mind control, right? This is these are not the droids you're looking for. When you say you were on Elm Street, you want to wave your hand and have Jason parrot back to you, we were not on Elm Street.
Right. There is a question from social media. This is from Mike. He says, at the 1 hour, 28 minute mark, there was a pause and you can hear a paper being turned over. And it sounds like he says, I can't see the paper. Does anyone else hear this? Mike asks.
Oh, I did not actually hear that.
Yeah, I have not heard that either.
Robbie, this could be this season's tap, 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 right?
It could be, and it would be amazing if one of our listeners caught it. But I'll go back and drill down into that bit of audio.
One of the things that came up, you know, you've got two different people. They confess to the same crime and implicate the same people. Isn't the most rational explanation that they did it?
No. And again, what I would say is the issue here is this timing piece, right? This is very common, right? So, like, what is done is Jason is coerced into making these statements. This Jedi mind control is well in effect. Jason is then used by the interrogators to induce Tony into making this statement. Tony is young, younger than Jason, I think. Young man who's had a troubled past, as we've already heard on the podcast. He's extremely vulnerable to influence. And he has been, we think of these as two separate statements, and they aren't. This is one piece. It's just from two separate mouths, but this is the same event. This is the same origin. It comes from the same place, and it's based on the same stuff. The same reasons that Jason's statements have been coerced is the same reasons that Tony's statements are coerced. And in fact, Jason's coercion is what coerced Tony, right? So like these things are very intertwined. It's not surprising at all that this is how it happened. It would be more surprising if Tony was able to resist that. One of the things we think so often is that it's so, you would never confess to something that you didn't do. And that's like a very, very, very common, obviously, assumption that people make. But this is actually super duper common, right? So I'm not a huge numbers person, but in DNA exonerations in this country, right? Almost 24% involved a false confession. That's almost a quarter of the cases. Actually quite common, right? So DNA proves that you could not have committed this offense, and 24% of those involve a false confession. People think this is going to benefit them. They're going to go home. The truth is going to come out. They're not going to be punished. It's so common to hear this, like, I would never, ever do this. But the reality is, if you grow up thinking that police are authorities and they're to be respected and that they're honest truth seekers, their opinion of you matters to you. And when they don't believe in your innocence, it's very easy for even you to buy into that, even if it's about yourself, especially when one of those police officers is your own mother. That person that many of us try for our entire lifetimes to please, right? We are trying to please and pacify, and we are lulled by that trust and respect that we have for police officers and our family members into believing that those desires to please and pacify are more important in the moment than telling the truth. We think the truth is going to come out eventually, and we trust that these people have our best interests at heart. And when really the case is that they have interests that go beyond our personal interests. And I think this is very evident in this case.
Robbie, we have a question from Amy, and she asks, was there any indication that Ken and Sharon were looking to build a house instead of buying one? Perhaps that's how Ken lured Sharon to the site. Or perhaps, I'd pose, perhaps that's how Ken would have known about, you know, that construction site. What do you know?
Yeah, I mean, they were apparently looking to buy a house. I'm sure Sharon was just as interested in looking at all the many new homes being built in the area. So we don't have any documentation to show specifically that they've been in contact with a builder or anything like that. But I think it's very, yeah, I mean, it's easy to understand how he could have gotten her out there. And if it wasn't even for the reason to take a look at a home, it could just be like, hey, how about a quickie type of thing? I'm like, you know, I don't know. But definitely they had been looking, according to Melanie, there had been some realtor they were working with over the summer to look at different houses.
Also have a question here. It says Tony's and Jason's manager remembered seeing Jason's truck when he went to pick up Tony, but it's not clear where that night fits into the timeline. Could you explain more?
Yeah, that is apparently the night of the murder. So Tony and Jason's manager was this guy named George McDonald, also called Scott McDonald, also had like 20 other aliases apparently. Yeah. And he picked up Tony from Webster House, Webster Street in Manchester. And he says that as he was driving away, he noticed Jason's truck at the Meineke, which I guess was down the street, a couple blocks away. And he noticed Jason was just kind of sitting in his truck that night. Jason was supposed to work, but he just bailed. So, but he says he saw the truck. So, you know. We don't know for sure if he really did or didn't, so we'll get into that a little bit later. But it's supposed to be the night of the murder. But, you know, if we were just to take that at face value, he says he picked up Tony around close to 10 p.m.
Now, Don asks, so if the victim is at the mall until 9:30, whose car was at the construction site when the Chuck E. Cheese family dropped by?
I don't know. we have, like, I mean, it could be anybody, all right? I mean, like, so the family the couple that were there that night said that it wasn't the first time they had swung by to check on the progress of what they were having built, and they often found like stuff that had been discarded there. It could have been anybody. I mean, it could have been Sharon and Ken. It could have been anybody. But I think what's to me more significant is the fact that at that time, there's no it doesn't seem, although maybe they just didn't see it, at that time, there doesn't seem to be a body laying out in the open, right? Or there doesn't seem to be, like, they haven't stumbled in onto an attack itself happening. My theory is that Sharon was attacked after this. So, you know, it didn't happen until after these folks left. So I don't know who was in that car. It might be people who have nothing to do with this case. But Cynthia, I don't know. What do you think?
Man, if I knew the answer to what happened, I don't know that we would be even having this podcast. I don't know if we'd be having this conversation. I don't know. And the reality is that, you know, I'm trying really hard to keep my mind really open and to not make assumptions, because I'm just trying to do, you know, what was not done in the case. You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to make sure I don't make assumptions about stuff. So I really don't know. And I don't have a theory. I don't know.
We've got a great question from Twitter, and it deals about motive. Why would Tony help kill Sharon to cover up Ken raping Lisa? Didn't Tony want to reconnect with Lisa because he loved her? Wouldn't he be more likely to want to kill Ken for raping the mother of his child?
I think the reality of this is that this entire line of Ken raping Lisa is just not true. Mm-hmm. So, that is all concocted by the police. And I think that's actually very consistent with what we've been discussing throughout this podcast. They don't care about the facts. They've got a theory, and they will pull anything that matches that theory and discount anything that doesn't. So this entire scenario, Ken didn't rape Lisa. That didn't happen. So right. The reality is that anything that has to do with that is completely manufactured. So I don't know. The motive is sort of irrelevant because it didn't happen.
It's really weird to me. I never understood some of the things I can understand, but that part I never understood. That didn't have to be a motive to kill Sharon for Ken. I mean, I don't know why Lammy, knowing that that had been like it was complete garbage, just kept on it. I don't understand it.
Because it's anything that's going to get you where you have decided it's going. I think that's why.
And it seems like it'd be so simple to disprove that Ken is the father of Lisa's child, right? I mean, we didn't have 23andMe, but it, you know, a regular old fashioned paternity test would sort of disprove that.
Yeah. And also, if I remember correctly, Cynthia, correct me if I'm wrong, this is something that Jason repeats. I don't think Tony ever does.
No, I think this is one of the details that never makes it into Tony's statement, but it's one of the details to me that stands out the most in Jason's statement because it's so obviously not true. Right? Yeah. It's just like obviously police manufactured detail that's incorrect. So when it appears in Jason's statement, to me, that is an immediate alarm bell.
Yeah. And Jason, by the way, has no idea who Lisa is, doesn't even know these people exist other than the fact that he's being told that these people exist. I think the reason it doesn't show up in Tony's is because they knew that Tony would be like, what the hell are you talking about? That's my kid. none of that's happening.
We have a question from Margaret. She wants to know, do all people in New Hampshire sound like they're 40 years old when they're actually 19? It's hard living up here, Margaret. Cold winters, hot summers, mud season. Come on. We're hardy, flinty New Englanders. But yeah, the sound quality of some of these things does not sound. Jason does have
a pretty deep voice, though. Jason's got a deep voice.
So I've got a whole bunch of questions on social media about things like the trial and what lawyers presented, and I feel like they're going to be spoilers. But I've just got to ask, Robbie, for folks that are dying to know, will that be covered as far as the things that the defense told the jury that seemed like they're winning arguments, or the things that prosecutors did or left out? I know it's undisclosed. We're going to go over that, right?
Of course. I mean, we couldn't not go over it. I mean, look, we've gotten to the point where arrests are now being made. Yeah, what comes next naturally is the trial. Trials.
All right. Well, Cynthia Mousseau, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck on your continued work for Jason Carroll.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope everybody continues to follow the fight, the continued path to Jason's freedom. And thank you so much for doing this podcast. And I'm really glad to be here.
And Rabia, can you tell us how has the reaction been to the case so far? Are you getting feedback from anybody?
Oh, yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I'm getting more of a reaction, I think, this season than we've gotten in quite a while. I'm getting a lot on Twitter, especially getting a lot of, this is the most bonkers thing I've ever heard. This is the most enraging case. This is, and I think especially when people heard some of the confession tape with their own ears, it's very different than somebody reading you a transcript. And also, you know, people waited like for weeks. They're like, well, where's Jason Carroll in this case? And now that we've gotten to Jason Carroll, they're like, why the hell does Jason Carroll have anything to do with this? So yeah, they are feeling like, I guess, what anybody who knows anything about this case has been feeling for a long time.
Well, if you have questions about this case or any of the other cases covered on Undisclosed, like maybe a ninja renting an airplane to fly across the state to kill somebody.
There was that one.
Come back. Yeah, that's a little bonkers too. Well, you can ask them on social media or you can look for Undisclosed Pod on all the platforms. Thanks so much to executive producer Methil Talhan and to Colin, Rabia, and Susan for continuing to let me be part of their work. For everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening. More to come next week.